Just over a week ago, the Ontario government announced it was reducing tuition fees at colleges and universities by 10%. Our very own MPP, David Pacini, from Northumberland, Peterborough South, was there in his role as parliamentary assistant to the Minister of Training, Colleges and Universities. For many local students who are now in school or planning to go off to university to get a post-secondary education, this is welcome news. And no doubt parents are also welcoming the announcement. But not everybody is happy. Today I have on our show Noor Al-Adid. She is the president of the Canadian Federation of Students. They represent university and college students across Canada, and she joins me now on the phone. Welcome, Noor. Are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yep, I can. Sorry.
Sorry.
That's great. Now, before we get too far along, I think it's really important for the sake of transparency that everyone knows that I'm a professor of journalism at an Ontario college. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I am doing this interview today is to help inform local students and parents about this topic. Now, many young people are applying to university and colleges right now, so this is going to have a profound impact on them. So, Noor, when you heard the Ontario government was dropping tuition fees, what was your first reaction?
Yeah, we were initially very cautious when we heard that announcement because we knew, you know, that the Auditor General reported in December that they were sort of leaving the door open for cuts to OSAP. So as much as we welcomed tuition fee cuts, we were waiting for the rest of the announcement to be released on Thursday so we could really get the bigger picture.
And when you heard the rest of the information on Thursday, can you tell us what was your response then?
Yeah, well, then the other shoe dropped and we saw the full picture and understood what was happening here. It was really disappointing to see the number of cuts that were made to OSAP. The government reverted the OSAP program back to the 2016-2017 model. Unfortunately, that was not as an effective model, I would say. The changes that were made in September 2017 really ensured that low-income students had access to enough grants to cover their tuition fees, which was a very welcome change amongst many other things related to interest fees and eligibility for mature students, part-time students, and so much more. Then we also heard the changes to the Student Choice Initiative, which really was just a drop. It felt like a drop kick because it was really attacking the organizations and the student groups that try to hold the government accountable and who try to further students' interests. So it was quite disappointing. I wouldn't have called it a good day for students.
Okay, so we'll talk a bit about those ancillary fees in a moment, but I'd like to go back. Maybe not everybody's been following this as closely as maybe you or I.
Yeah.
So can you tell me what the system was before? You talked about some changes that took place in 2016, 2017. So can you just take us back and unpack what happened there?
Yeah, so in 2017, the OSAP program changed in a number of different ways. So for example, the biggest change was that the Federation had recommended to OSAP that they amalgamate a number of grants that had previously existed.
Okay, before we go too far, let's just, so everybody understands, OSAP is the Ontario Student Assistance Program. This is where students go if they need financial assistance to go to school. So carry on, please.
No worries. So what we had recommended was amalgamating a number of very niche grants. Those grants were sort of difficult to access based on their eligibility. So what we told the government was amalgamate them all together so more students could access them. And it was a great change because we saw when it rolled out September 2017 that, again, over 210,000 students were able to access enough grants to cover their tuition fees, regardless if they were in college or university. Other changes that were made were regarding parental and spousal income and acknowledging the fact that not all students have access to that wealth if it exists. There may be some personal disputes between students and their parents or students and their spouse. And to ensure that a student doesn't have to rely on their parents, we were able to change the formula so that parental and spousal income wasn't as a heavy factor in the formula that determined how much a student would access at the end of the day. Other changes were around eligibility. So if a student had been outside of post-secondary education for more than 4 years, they would still be able to access this grant, which was really great considering how our economy is fluctuating and we're seeing closures to major things like, General Motors. it would have been beneficial for, you know, individuals who aren't, you know, the typical 18 to 24 year old going to university to have access to grants, because we know that those people are also working, they're supporting families, they have other responsibilities. So the grant system really changed to provide folks with as much support as possible. So when we're reverting back to the 2016-2017 model, this is really gutting all of those changes and putting students back on a loan system, meaning that when they graduate, they have to pay back those loans with interest. And it really puts us in a cycle of debt that's hard to get out of when we are balancing so many responsibilities like rent, food, families, and so much more.
So let's really distinguish and make it clear for the listeners the difference between grants and loans. So if I'm a student coming new to the system, what's a grant and what's a loan?
Yeah, a grant is non-repayable. So it's amount of money that's allocated to the student to pay for their school that they do not have to pay back. A loan can be a private loan from a bank or from, you know, the government, where they lend you that money. And at the end of your degree, you have to pay it back in installments or a lump sum if you have that money. But you are charged interest on that amount.
Now, to be eligible for a grant, there must be some kind of criteria. Do you know what that is?
Yeah, so the criteria ranges. It could be based on your income, but it could also be based on things like, are you the first student to go to post-secondary education in your family? Are you a part of a marginalized group, for example, First Nations, Métis, or Inuit students? Are you a student with a disability who requires some support with technology, and so forth?
Now, does every student get a grant? I mean, no matter how much your parents make or whatever, does everybody get
a
grant?
No, it really does fluctuate. And now that we're going back to the 2016-2017 model, the amount or the ratio of grants to loans will decrease, meaning you'll have more loans than non-repayable grants.
All right. So, and how easy is it to get a loan? I mean, are there criteria to that as well?
There is criteria, but it is easier to get a loan than it is a grant, simply because the responsibility is put back on you to pay it back once you graduate.
Now, why would I want to get a loan from OSAP than, say, go to a bank or some other financial institution and get a student loan?
I think there's pros and cons to both of them. At the end of the day, I don't believe in a loan system. I think the part of charging interest on that loan means that a student who couldn't afford it at first will end up paying more for the same degree as opposed to a student who had the funds to pay it up front. That's a conversation with families and students that they need to have about whether they want to take on that responsibility. The difference between a bank loan and a student loan often depends on like the interest amount, and the interest amount by banks is set by, you know, the interest rates that they charge. For loans, they tend to be a little bit more, like the interest tends to be a little bit higher, but because we're able to lobby, and student unions in particular are able to lobby OSAP, we're able to see changes and sometimes see OSAP relief, where there's like loan relief where you don't actually have to pay a certain amount back. And the structure of how you pay that loan back will differ if you get it from a bank or if you get it from the government.
Now, one of the things that we've heard the government say is that the system that currently existed, that wealthy people were getting loans and grants, and that it was anybody could get it, and the system was really not being aimed where it was supposed to go, which was to those who were disadvantaged. From your experience, is that true?
That's misrepresented information, in my opinion, because, again, what I wanted to emphasize are those students who do have wealthy parents but are not able to access that wealth because of their relationship with their parents. And what ends up happening with those students is that they will take on multiple jobs. I've actually helped students with financial appeals at my institution when this has happened. And the reality is that not every student has access to that wealth. And those are, you know, done by case-by-case basis, where the student has to explain to OSAP why they're applying for it in the first place, and often have to explain that relationship between their parents and themselves or their spouse and themselves as to why they can't access that wealth.
All right, but I can hear people saying, well, but, you know, maybe they make up stories, or maybe they make it sound worse than it really is. I mean, and they're ripping the system off. How do you hit that balance between, you know, those who are in true need and those who are just taking advantage of the system?
I think at the end of the day, when you're dealing with that student one-on-one, you can tell the difference between somebody who is misrepresenting, you know, their life experiences and who is not. It's not an easy thing to be paying off, thousands of dollars of you know, loans. And the reality is there's a deadline to pay that money back to your institution. Or like, for example, we pay them in chunks, right? So you have one installment in September and one installment in January. When that student has come to you in October and is being charged interest by the university or the college because they haven't met that deadline, but they can't access that money from OSAP and they can't access that money from their parents, they're in a tough pickle. It means that they can't make their rent. They can't afford food. They're using food centers on campus. They're living with friends to make up that cost. And I think that we have to give students the benefit of the doubt and acknowledge that tuition fees don't have to be that expensive. That's not the norm that we want to strive for. And there are solutions and we should strive for that.
Now, OSAP's often had a varying public image in people's minds over the decades. And at one point, I mean, I can remember it being called the Ontario Stereo Assistance Program and, you know, that kind of derogatory comments. How do we change that in people's minds that it's not a system that's being abused?
I think we really need to recenter the conversation on what education is about and why we value it as a society and how we can ensure that it is accessible for all. The reality is that places around the world that also have free education still have a grant system and a financial aid system. For example, Germany, where, you know, education is free for students in post-secondary education, but they still have that grant system to alleviate costs related to rent, food, textbooks, and so much more. And obviously, like, it ranges from place to place based on what the current issues are in that society. I think in Ontario, we really struggle to find high quality, well-paying, consistent jobs. So where do we expect students to find the money to fund post-secondary education when our wages had been frozen for so long, but our tuition fees were increasing at a faster rate than inflation? I think, again, like, this is going to be a larger conversation about shifting finances accordingly to make post-secondary accessible, but also acknowledging the other responsibilities and factors that make living in Ontario very difficult.
Well, I mean, if you listen to what the government's saying, they're saying that this is going to make it much more affordable. It's going to make it much more accessible. Why don't you see it the way that they do? I mean, they seem to think that this is going to streamline and make it much more effective and efficient.
Well, I love talking about efficiencies. My major is economics. It's my favorite thing to talk about. But I'm not quite sure that they're framing it in a way that's most efficient for the people that they're representing. The tuition fee cut, though I welcome, again, is actually going to benefit people who could already afford it. Because at the end of the day, if you're cutting tuition fees but also cutting OSAP, they cancel each other out. So the people who need the support the most aren't going to be able to, you know, make ends meet because, sorry, if you're talking about the average amount of tuition fees for university, you're seeing about a $600, you know, savings in the grand scheme of a $6,000 tuition fee. That's still not that much. Or when you're talking about colleges and you're saving $300, but you still have to make up the $3,000, $4,000 tuition fee, it's not really a saving. And when OSAP is being cut, they cancel each other out.
Now, what about, we talked a bit about barriers and you've talked a bit about spousal support and parental support, but there are many other kinds of barriers as well. I know that, you know, some students face issues around housing or textbooks. Yeah. Can you talk a bit about those additional expenses that students often face, transportation, those kinds of things?
Yeah. Well, it ranges across the province and we represent students up in Northern Ontario all the way to Windsor and Ottawa and the GTA. And each area has its unique realities. For example, I'll say that, you know, in London, Ontario, the cost of rent isn't the same as the cost of rent in Toronto and what that means for the GTA campuses. So a lot of students in the GTA will struggle to pay rent when it's at around, you know, an average, if you're sharing a room with multiple people, your rent might be at around $700, $900. Textbooks, when you buy them brand new and they're always changing editions, textbooks can amount to nearly $500 or more than that. So these costs are always added on. And what I'll tie it back to is the amazing campaign around the $15 minimum wage, the Fight for 15 in Fairness. And they really highlighted the fact that students back in the day could work over the summer, you know, a part-time job and save that money and be able to afford a year's worth of their tuition fees. Now, when we're looking at the, you know, 2018-2019 numbers, students have to work the entire year at you know, full-time and balance full-time studies to be able to afford that, that tuition fee amount. but also expenses like rent, like tuition fees. Maybe they have children, maybe they have a dependent that they have to take care of and so forth. So all of these things do tend to, you know, pile on. And what that ends up meaning is that students are balancing multiple minimum wage jobs, running across from, you know, across the city to, or across town to make those jobs like balance out, and still struggling to be in class, take care of their well-being, and make those payments on time.
Would you have, Go ahead.
I was going to say, it's not just the stress of getting a 4.0 in school. It's also the stress of making sure that you make your payments on time.
Now, what about, do you have any statistics about how many students actually hold a job while they're going to school?
I can find that number for you, because it does range from campus to campus, but a fair, like, the average student is working a minimum wage job to make ends.
At least some hours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I would say minimum 10 hours a week.
10 hours a week. Wow.
Yeah.
Now, some people might say, well, you know, students always live financially close to the bone. I mean, we hear the stories about eating Kraft dinner or living mm-hmm. in a dingy basement apartment.
Yeah.
I mean, there's always been sort of this thing about struggling to get your education mm-hmm. and make your way in the world. Can you tell me how true is this scenario? If you were to paint a modern picture, how would you describe it?
Yeah, I think there are a number of students who are contemplating still living with their parents. I'll speak to, you know, Northern Ontario students. A variety of them find it very difficult to move someplace else for post-secondary education because they don't have the funding to do so. So they try to stay at home or live close to the institution to make ends meet. We're seeing numbers spike when it comes to food centers on campus and in the community being used by students. And we know that because of, like, the demographic or the age that they indicate on their, like, applications.
Mm-hmm.
Other students, I'm trying to rack my brain for it. It's also, like, when we're looking at statistics after a student graduates and how often students are looking to extend or push back their loan repayment or the amount that they're paying back. Oftentimes, there's small amounts over a long period of time with interest. But the it's because those monthly payments can pile up, so they try to take on smaller loan repayments instead of large ones to get rid of it faster. I'm trying to think. Can you repeat your question? Because I'm trying to
No,
wrap my
brain. I'm trying to get you to paint me a picture of what a student's mm-hmm. life is like. You know, we have these traditional images of, you know, a hardworking mm-hmm. student living in a basement yeah. apartment, eating yeah. Kraft dinner five times a week. And, yeah. you know, that's sort of a romanticized vision.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying to get you to paint me a picture of mm-hmm. some of the students that you know, or maybe some of the people that you know. Maybe you yeah. could share some stories that describe what students are going through and why these things are so vital and so important.
Yeah. Well, for a full-time student, oftentimes I think their class schedules can be like a 9-to-5 type day, or they try to arrange their week schedule so that way they could be at work as well. Our transit system across the province obviously varies from place to place, but they all have their unique difficulties. So students will either have to make the tough decision between purchasing a car and paying for parking and insurance and gas, or taking transit and that commute being an hour, 2 hours on average. For some students, that's not even an option because their transit system is that poor. For a part-time student, I would say that for us, I'm a part-time student. That range is where you're balancing a full-time job, family responsibilities, but also trying to balance in your classes and working with students. Like, oftentimes, a lot of our assignments are also group work, and that can be difficult because you're trying to balance the schedules of, you know, five students who have varying responsibilities, but you still need to find time to work together on this group assignment. For graduate students, it's also different because they do research and they work with their supervisor. So those individuals not only are working and TAing and marking and playing a role at the institution through an academic lens, but they are also doing their own research and trying to find a job to make ends meet in the meantime until they